Hello and welcome to a Weekly Stuff bonus podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here, as always, to talk about Doctor Who.
Yes.
Our monthly Doctor Who bonus episode reaches something of a culmination this month.
Yeah.
As we reach the tenure of the seventh and final classic Doctor.
Yes, of the contiguous TV series that started in 1963.
Yes.
We are going to, and we're doing this from an episode of the year of 1989 when the show is ultimately canceled.
Yes, we are talking about the Sylvester McCoy serial, Ghost Light.
Yes, a very strange and I think brilliant story in Doctor Who to sort of cap off a strange and brilliant era in the show.
Yes. So, Sean, to recap to the listeners, we have been doing these once a month for 8 months now, where we revisit a piece of classic Doctor Who history. We have been going Doctor by Doctor. We spent 2 months with Tom Baker, because the dude deserves it.
Yeah, you know, 7 years gets you 2 months of podcast.
Yes. So we spent 2 months with him. We've been going through the fifth and sixth Doctor eras, which are rocky and had some weird stories to look at.
Yeah.
And now we arrive at the seventh Doctor, who... I think among people who have seen Sylvester McCoy, you're never going to find someone say a bad word about him.
Yeah.
And you'll find a lot of enthusiasm. But I also don't hear him and his era talked about in, like, broader Doctor Who conversation as much as some other periods of the show. And Sean, yeah. I know you are a big fan of this part of the show.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
So why don't we start there? What makes this interesting?
Well, there's a lot of stuff going on. I think one of the reasons why people like don't talk about his era that much is that it is, even though he has more seasons than Colin Baker, he doesn't really have any more stories because they, after, you know, the sort of the debacle of the Sixth Doctor era and Trial of a Time Lord and the near cancellation of the show, the disastrous music video Doctor in Distress, the BBC just generally despising the show, despising the people who make the show, despising the lead actor in the show, even though we all agree on this podcast, Colin Baker's fucking amazing. The BBC did not like him at the time. And so the BBC just hated everything about Doctor Who, wanted Doctor Who destroyed. So after all of that, they, you know, there was a pretty severe cut down in the number of stories and episodes they had. So it became four serials per season for three seasons, and two of those serials would be four episodes long. And they started doing a weird thing where two of the serials were three episodes. And Ghost Light is one of those three-episode serials. And so, like, the only time in the history of the show that that was a regular thing, it was a weird sort of format change. And so
there are only 14 episodes per year
for
McCoy, which, if you were to compare that now, that would be 7 hour-long episodes, roughly. So it's way shorter than any, like, modern or other season of Doctor Who.
Yeah, so the overall material from the Sylvester McCoy era is, like, more or less comparable in terms of the amount of material you have from the Colin Baker eras, even though he had one more season than Colin Baker had. So it's kind of weird when you think back on it that way, because when I think back on it, I always forget that it's like, there's not that much. Like, you can watch through all of Sylvester McCoy's stories, like, in one day if you wanted to. Like, you could just do this massive Seventh Doctor marathon and just go through the whole thing. But it is a real, real bright spot at the end of the run for a couple of reasons. Other than the first season, which is pretty rough, with the exception of the story Paradise Towers, which is the second story of season 24, which is Sylvester McCoy's first, I think Paradise Towers is great. There are a lot of people that don't like that story. Those people are wrong. Paradise Towers is funny, and it's hilarious. It's great. But then season 25, and then his last season, and the last season, season 26, both of those seasons are really fucking strong and don't have, like, a single terrible story. The only one that's, like, kind of rough is Silver Nemesis from season 25. Other than that, Remembrance of the Daleks, The Happiness Patrol, The Greatest Show in the Galaxy, Battlefield, Ghostlight, The Curse of Fenric, and Survival, those are all, like, good to great Doctor Who stories.
So particularly his last season.
Yeah, his last season, the whole thing is fucking awesome.
Doctor Who went out swinging for the fences.
Absolutely. And it's like the overall quality of the show was really good right at the very end. And it was also, it just got weird and different and experimental. And I like the, you know, the talk is always, and as far as my research goes, this is generally proven true as far as I can understand it, is that one of the main reasons behind that is the introduction of our new script editor, Andrew Cartmell. So, at the end of the Sixth Doctor era, we had Eric Sayward, who had stayed on for a long time. He had stayed on for almost all of the Fifth Doctor era. You know, there was that weird, like, the first Fifth Doctor season has, like, three different script editors, like, touching it. But it was generally Eric Sayward. And I think we talked about this at the end of the Colin Baker episode, that Eric Saward and John Nathan Turner, the producers, relationship got very sour there at the end. A lot of that relating to issues relating to Robert Holmes' death and the treatment of the scripts thereafter and that kind of stuff. So Eric Saward quit. John Nathan Turner wanted to quit but couldn't because nobody else was like up to bat to take the job. So he was like shackled to the show because he was like basically put in the situation where if John Nathan Turner quit, the show was canceled. So he's like, well, fuck. I'm not going to be the dude who takes down Doctor Who with me by choice, right? So he decides to stay with the show.
These guys were basically like the orchestra on the Titanic.
Yes.
They were playing. They're like, there's no room on the boats for us. We're playing until this fucker sinks.
That is exactly what it was like. And then Michael Grade in the BBC decided they fired Colin Baker. And so then John Nathan Turner had to replace his script editor and had to replace his lead on very short notice. And so then they looked around, got Sylvester McCoy, which, like, great fucking choice.
Best decision they ever made.
Yeah, he's so weird, so different. He's just, like, brings such a different kind of flavor to the show because he's comic in, like, a very physical way that that Peter Davison and Colin Baker particularly were not. That it, like, kind of, like, goes back a bit to, like, that Patrick Troughton. He's very mischievous, but then he also has, a darkness to him that they caught on to really quickly.
It's like a dark elf.
Yes, like a dark elf. Yes, a dark elf.
Yes.
If you say it in, like, if it's, like...
I don't mean, like, the class in a video game.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, he's, like, an elf or a troll something under a bridge who plays dark tricks on people.
Yes, there are two ways that you can pronounce that. It's either it's a dark elf or it's a dark elf.
Yes, dark comma elf.
Yes, he's a dark elf. He's an evil, like, whimsical, like, gremlin motherfucker. Which was not initially how they played it. Initially, they played it very comic, and I think it is his performance in the Paradise Towers episode. You see a little bit of the mischief and the what's going on, the wheels spinning in his head, and him manipulating people in that story. And so, the new script editor they got, Andrew Cartmell, who was pretty young at the time. I think it seems like he caught on to that, and so after season 24, they really leaned into this direction of the character of let's make him mysterious. Again, like go back to the Doctor Who part of the show, which is something like the show like routinely goes through this phase of like, oh, we kind of know too much about this dude. Like let's cast Tom Baker and make him fucking crazy. It's like, we know too much about this dude. Let's cast Sylvester McCoy and make him really weird. And it's like, you know, we too know too much about this dude. Let's cast fucking Peter Capaldi and scare the shit out of everybody with his fucking eyebrows, right? Like, it's something that the TV show just goes through periodically.
Yes.
And so with this one, they started leaning into that, like, sort of like the dark genius, like the Machiavellian manipulating people. They introduced the companion Ace at the end of season 24. And so we get her for McCoy's last two seasons fully. And she's an interesting companion because she's very aggressive, very young, very hot-headed, but has like this spark in her that the Doctor sees. And so his sort of Machiavellianism is kind of trying to push her and pull her to like become better and stronger and kind of evolve her in some ways. And that whole process started, like, got this reputation as being called the Cartmell Master Plan after Andrew Cartmell, the script editor, who was kind of trying to push the show into this direction of the sort of the overall plan was eventually to have Ace go to Gallifrey and enter the Time Lord Academy and have her become a Time Lady, which would have been interesting. They never, like, obviously the show got canceled before they got to go in that direction. But Cartmell started sort of experimenting with putting those little seeds of, like, character drama and character development building up to this larger story that never really culminated, but the most we see of it is in this last sort of trilogy of stories, Ghostlight, Curse of Fenric, and Survival, which all deal with different elements of Ace's past that are sort of a key part of the story and her character, and kind of like digging into who she is, and the Doctor trying to kind of like get her to face her past and her traumas to advance herself. And that concept and the way that Cartmell sort of designs it as a script editor is one of the interesting things, is that Cartmell is like one of the only script editors to have never actually like basically written a story for the show. Like, he was basically purely an editor and like was concerned with editing the scripts and introducing larger sort of like storytelling concerns to the show. But he is, I think, one of the better script editors in the whole history of the show, just for being able to find a new direction for the character, find a new sort of like way to tackle Doctor Who right at the end there. And it's really sad that he never got to sort of see those sort of storytelling ambitions all the way through. But holy fucking shit, is it a hell of a ride seeing where he was trying to go.
So obviously the Seventh Doctor, Sylvester McCoy, has done a fuck ton of material for Big Finish.
Oh, yes.
Have they brought Ace back and done any more of what they might have done with this?
Yes. Like, the Ace stuff gets really complicated because one of the things that happens is obviously between 1989 and 1996 when they do the TV movie and they have the Eighth Doctor, there's a lot of comic books and novelizations. Like the story Ghostlight was originally going to be Lungbarrow, which is a whole story that was going to be related to, like, digging into, like, the Time Lord history and, like, kind of messing with that stuff. That strip kind of got abandoned and replaced with Ghostlight, but that Lungbarrow story, which would have been kind of important to building up all, like, the larger ideas of the Cardinal Master Plan, that eventually turned into a novel and that kind of stuff. And yes, like, Sophie Aldred is in a bunch of the Seventh Doctor stories as Ace, and they kind of toy with it a bit, but, like, that continuity is kind of, like, obviously very crazy because it's sort of unhinged from a strong, like, single storytelling, right, like, direction that Cardinal had. But yeah, like, that continues to be a theme in the extraneous material, whether it's in the novels, the comic books, or the audios. The Doctor manipulating her and trying to kind of draw out things about her is definitely a thing that keeps on going on.
Interesting.
Yes. Yeah, those audios are well worth listening to, for sure.
I've asked this before. Are there any recommendations for Seventh Doctor audio dramas off the top of your head?
Off the top of my head, I don't remember what they're called off the top of my head, but there's a whole... I think it's basically when they started doing the trilogies that have this one Nazi scientist named Klein that is a temporary companion for him. Those stories are really good. You can find out which ones those are very easily. I think Kolditz is the story that introduces that character.
I have that one.
Yeah, that one's an earlier one that introduces that character, that scientist, and they bring her back later. David Tennant is also in Kolditz as a minor role, because this is recorded before Doctor Who came back, I think.
Right.
There's that one. I can't remember any of the others off the top of my head, but those are the ones that stick out for me in my memory.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I would check those out. Because nice. Also, any of the ones that, like, as much as I really like his companions, and they introduce an interesting companion character named Hex that has a relationship with Ace, my favorite Sylvester McCoy audios are the ones where he's alone, and, like, they introduce different new characters for him to bounce off of, because they take the Seventh Doctor to this super dark place where he's been, like, traveling alone for, like, 100 years or something, and it's very nice. Good.
I just like imagining between the end of the season we're in now and the movie where he gets shot to death in San Francisco.
Yes.
He's seen some shit.
Yo, absolutely, 100%, that is the direction they take that character. It's really fucking good.
Yes, because, I mean, should we mention that obviously the show is canceled at the end of this season we're talking about here.
Yeah.
But that wasn't the end for Sylvester McCoy, not just talking about Big Finish either.
Yes, no, like, he very graciously came back to film the beginning, like, opening sequence and his regeneration scene in the TV movie in 1996. I think he's really good in that.
He's very memorable.
Yes, he gets to hang out in a dope fucking TARDIS set with a really nice costume that eschews the question marks for him. That's, like, very Seventh Doctor, just doesn't have any question marks, and he's hanging around. I think he's reading, like, The Time Machine by H.G. Wells, because of course he is.
Yes.
Yes. And he gets to have a very nice Frankensteinian, like, regeneration scene where they're, like, operating him. He's like, I have two hearts! Like, yes. What are you talking about?
It is just, if you've never seen the TV movie, it's a trip for so many reasons. Part of it is watching, you know, the Doctor, character we all love in all these different forms. He goes to America for the first fucking time, steps out and gets shot to death by a street gang in San Francisco.
Yes.
Because, you know, that's America for you.
You know...
It is.
Gun control people, we need to take it seriously. We're killing fucking the Doctor now.
Yeah. Doctor Who got shot to death. That's in San Francisco. No one even really thinks of San Francisco. I love that too. That, like, the Doctor goes to America and the city they decide to associate with rampant gun violence is San Francisco.
Yeah, he doesn't land in, like, a dark alley in Detroit. Yeah. It's you know, the city of flowers.
Yes. So anyway, yeah. But I always remember that because just the regenerations in this era of the show are so fucking weird, with, like, 6 to 7, and then 7 to 8 here.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's all
for those who don't know, because I don't think I specifically mentioned this, since Colin Baker was fired, he very understandably did not want to come back to film a regeneration scene.
Yes.
He's like, I do not blame the dude for being like, fuck you guys. Like, I was supposed to have 3 seasons, and he fucking fired. It's like, fucked up. So he did not show up. So the way that the Sixth Doctor regenerates into the Seventh Doctor in the TV show continuity, like, Big Finish goes back and, like, kind of tries to, like, smooth this transition out in some ways that are pretty cool. But in terms of the original TV show, it is Sylvester McCoy in a blonde wig piloting the TARDIS, and you see him from behind, and the Ronnie, who is a very unmemorable villain, who appeared in one story before this point. She's an evil Time Lady. And then in Time and the Rani, which is the first Seventh Doctor story, is fucking terrible. And they're in some sort of TARDIS fight or something, I don't know. And the TARDIS set shakes a little bit. And the Doctor smacks his head on the TARDIS console, collapses, falls to the ground. And it turns over and you see that it's Sylvester McCoy wearing the big get-up.
Yes.
It's very slapdash.
Oh yeah, I have not seen all of Time and the Rani, but I've watched that sequence many times because it's fucking hilarious.
It's very much the show just like desperately trying to sort of like tape over these two eras.
In brief, can I ask what does Big Finish do with that? Because Colin Baker has a billion stories, but when he regenerates, Mel is still there. Yes. How do they explain all that?
That's all the stories with the other companions take place in some undescribed period in the middle. Yeah, they like do this whole, they do a whole thing where it's like...
I like to imagine he like leaves Mel at a McDonald's, goes off and has 200 years of adventure, he's like, oh fuck, and he goes back and gets Mel.
That's basically how my head continuity of Doctor Who always works, is whenever the Doctor's not explicitly on screen, he is probably like 100 years have passed, and he's been time traveling with like a shape-shifting penguin, you know?
Yes.
All kinds of nonsense happens when you're not watching.
Yes. All right. Do you want to get into talking about Ghostlight? Anything else but the era that's worthwhile to talk about?
One thing just to mention, because I think we mentioned some of this last time, because, you know, obviously the last episode we talked a lot about all the drama leading to Colin Baker leaving, is there's one important personnel change that I don't want to forget. Does it say, like, kind of fuck this guy? Michael Grade was the controller of BBC One during the Colin Baker years. He stepped down in 1987, and Jonathan Powell, who was the head of the drama department at BBC, which managed Doctor Who at the time, took over as controller of BBC One, which is still the most fucking, like, dystopian job title I feel like any TV person could have. Like, I desperately hope that one day in my life I have the position of controller and have, like, an office that someone, like, comes into and says, like, excuse me, is the controller here? And I get to spin around my chair. It's like, yes, I am he.
I want to make that my title on this podcast. Yes. I call myself the producer sometimes.
Yeah.
Controller of
the Weekly Stuff podcast. Yes. So, Jonathan Powell takes over as controller of BBC One from 1987. He is in that position to 1992, which obviously is the period of time in which, in 1989, Doctor Who is canceled. So he's the guy who directly sort of pushes the button and says, no more Doctor Who. And actually related to that is that Ghostlight is the last story made. Even though it is not, the survival was the last story aired, and then obviously they recorded the little like bit of dialogue they shoved at the end, the monologue, after all of this, to sort of like say, like, okay, we know the show's canceled, here's a little like speech from the Doctor and Ace to sort of like wrap that up. But Ghostlight was the last one, like, fully produced. So there's something weird. I didn't even remember that when I picked this story, but there's something weirdly appropriate about it.
It is sad to contemplate. Doctor Who's okay today, obviously.
Yes, it's
more than fine.
It's very easy being on the other side of it. Luckily, we did not have to live through the dark times, the wilderness years.
Yes.
Fans of Doctor Who.
I know. Now it's hard to imagine Doctor Who ever getting in that position again.
Right,
Time will pass. Something's going to give at some point. But, like, I mean, if you want an example, I was watching some of this episode with the trivia track that the DVDs have. The third episode of Ghostlight had ratings of 4 million viewers.
Yeah.
And, like, that would be low today. In 1989, that would be perilously, dangerously, oh my god, yes, you're going to get canceled low.
Yes. You know?
So, like, very few people were relatively watching Doctor Who at this point, and it's too bad.
Yeah, so there's, like, just for reference, that it has about the same viewership as the first ever episode of Doctor Who, An Unearthly Child, which was aired the day after President Kennedy was assassinated.
Yes.
So not that many people were watching. It's like, and then Doctor Who sort of catapulted to 10 million viewers in the first Doctor era after the Daleks were introduced, because people fucking like the Daleks in the 60s a lot. But yeah, so we're, like, back down to, like, really catastrophic ratings numbers of about 4 million viewers per episode.
Yeah, it's too bad.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about Ghostlight?
Fucking yeah, I want to talk about Ghostlight, my
friend. Can I do one more aside before we talk about Ghostlight?
Go ahead.
Because you mentioned earlier that episode Silver Nemesis isn't that good.
Yeah.
That's a Cyberman story, right?
Yes.
This has nothing to do with Ghostlight, but I am genuinely curious. Is there a good Cyberman story after Patrick Troughton leaves?
Earthshock. The one where Patrick is killed. That's the good one. Yeah. And, like, the Sixth Doctor one is not bad. Okay. Like, it's, you know, it's one of those, like, where you're kind of judging relative to the era that, that like, Attack of the Cybermen, Revenge of the Cybermen, bullshit of the, whatever the fuck it's called.
I'm just saying, if you had never watched a second Doctor story and, like, picked up with John Pertwee and only watched after that, you would look at the Cyberman mania of, like, modern Doctor Who and be like, where the fuck did those guys come from? They were in nothing but shitty stories.
Yeah.
And like one per Doctor. You know, Tom Baker had one in 7 fucking years and it's not good.
Yes. Yeah. The Cybermen, it was a dark, dark time for me who is a Cyberman fan. It's like, it really, it's a pretty dark time until like right now where it's like, wait, we made a fucking good Cyberman story again. Holy shit, it was like 30 years in the making.
Yes, between the 2nd and 12th Doctors.
Yeah, we finally got like a great Cyberman story. Like there were one or two good ones.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, just curious. Just, you know, this is a time for Doctor Who trivia. Ghostlight, Sean. Usually, I give my take first, I guess.
Because I'm always interested to hear. Because with the Seventh Doctor, you've seen, like we've already talked. You've seen the TV movie, and you watched Battlefield, which was the one we did.
Yes.
For the podcast we did like 5 lifetimes ago,
when we were still in high school,
yes.
Long time ago.
Yes, we were like seniors in high school. I think.
Yes, Battlefield, which is the direct precursor to this story, because
yes.
They aired. They're next to each other in the air order. And it's interesting because Battlefield, correct me if I'm wrong, phenomenal Doctor Who story.
Oh, absolutely.
But not necessarily like the most maybe, it's not the most ace heavy. It doesn't mm-hmm. necessarily showcase the most like crazy parts of the Seventh Doctor.
Yeah, it doesn't have like the Machiavellian stuff in there really. It's a big, fun, wacky like sci-fi adventure with the Brigadier and everything. It's
right.
Great. Yeah.
So I've always loved Battlefield. It's fantastic. But like, I was really interested to watch Ghostlight, and especially once it got going and I saw what this episode was going to be, which is batshit insane. Like, I felt like, okay, now I'm getting, like, full-on, undiluted Sylvester McCoy Doctor Who. I dug it. I love. Like, we've gone for a couple months here where Fifth Doctor story, Kinda, I didn't really like. Sixth Doctor story, Vengeance on Varos, I thought was good, not great. This one is, like, awesome. I don't know if it's the best Doctor Who haunted house story, because there is some stiff competition in like Pyramids of Mars or something, but this is really good, and to call it a Doctor Who haunted house story is kind of selling it short, because that's where it starts. That's not necessarily where it ends, and what happens along the way, it is nuts. It is such a good showcase for the Seventh Doctor. Like, this specific version of this story, I don't think there's another Doctor you could do this with.
No.
Maybe, like, a Capaldi in, like, season 8 when he is still really mean to everybody.
Yes, I could see that.
But I could see that, but, like, it is... But that's the thing, is, like, McCoy has that Patrick Troughton quality of he just walks into a room and commands it kind of by accident.
Yeah.
Because he just kind of, like... He assumes everyone will assume he's there for a good reason, and no one ever questions it, and he's weird enough that everyone rolls with it. And that's great, but then you realize, oh, he's 10 steps ahead of everybody in this story. He's figured everything out before it happens, or he thinks he's figured it out before it happens, and he's just being this Machiavellian, you know, evil elf about it the whole time. Ace, great showcase for her.
Yeah.
She's awesome. I can't wait to see all of this stuff when I get to it in my own rewatch. And see all of Ace in context, because she's awesome in this story. The supporting cast is amazing. The main... Well, there's kind of two main villains. Sure, but the main villain for parts 1 and 2, Josiah.
Yes.
Who looks like, if you did that today, he'd be played by John C. Reilly.
Yes.
He looks so
totally
much like John C. Reilly. Like, he doesn't sound like him, but especially when he's got all the makeup and the glasses on, he is like a villain out of a fucking comic book. I love him. And then... This episode really blows the back of your head off. The cliffhanger of part 2 into part 3. The end of part 2 is utter gibberish.
Yeah.
Where the Doctor like yells, "Light!" And then light comes up. Like the literal concept of light. And blares everyone in the eyes. And like, you know, ooh. And we cut to the end. And it's like, what's going on? And then it gets even weirder. Because in part 3, light is the physical manifestation of an evil god thing?
I think he has been retconned as an Eternal, which is a like alien species that features in a Fifth Doctor story called Enlightenment. I do not think that that was what they were trying to do at the time.
No.
But yeah, he's a very, like because we were talking about before recording it, he's a very Star Trek, the original series-y, like, Trelane kind of, or, like, kind of like Q from TNG. Like, that kind of, like weird, omnipotent being that you feel like you, like, he probably exists in, like, 20 dimensions, and you're seeing, like, one facet of his being, and he just, like, appears in rooms and travels at the speed of thought and all this bullshit.
He's like Q if Q and the person around Q, all the people around him, were all on LSD. That's what he's like. And it is not, like, this episode is wild, and it is weird, and I'm not sure at any point anyone making this has a full handle on what the story's about, but that's great. They're all, like, 70% there, and they don't have the same 70%, and it is fucking fascinating to watch. It is a roller coaster, Sean.
Yes, it's awesome. I've always really been fascinated by Ghostlight, and every time I watch it, I like it more and more, and I feel like I'm... Like, now, with this is the third time I've watched it, I feel like I'm getting to have, like, a pretty decent grasp on, okay, I think I kind of know what this thing is getting at. And I think it has, you know, it's also, I've always been really interested in that, like, Victorian period, and specifically the, like, issues of, like, science and religion and, like, gender and that, like, that weird sort of, like, cocktail of bullshit that the Victorians were messing with, because it's, like, right on the verge of, and, like, at the beginning of all these groundbreaking discoveries that, like, completely shatter their understanding of themselves and the world they live in, like, critical for this episode, Darwin and his theory of evolution, which is, like, a lot of what this story is ultimately about, feels like it's, like, change in life and evolution. Kind of in, like, a weird way, it's really appropriate that we did the Annihilation episode relatively recently, because, like, that movie and Ghostlight have weirdly really similar themes in some ways.
I had not made that connection personally, but I see where you're coming from on it.
Yeah,
it's... Absolutely, yes, because it is interested in, like, hard science in a lot of ways, but approaching it through a very weird, like, intentionally off-putting prism where nobody, like, diegetically fully grasps what's going on.
Yeah, and by the end it feels like you're not supposed to be able to grasp what's going on, because like we said, like with light, he exists in a way that we don't understand, but also we exist in a way that light, that entity, does not understand. It's like kind of like these battling concepts of what existence even means and is like do not compute with each other. And so, yeah, you just end with like this, like, particularly the conclusion of the story is very strange, where it's like, you know, the whole gang and the manor just sort of like disappear in the thought ship, and light just sort of freezes in place and like dissolves or whatever, and the Dr. Days are like, well, fuck it, let's leave.
Yeah, it really does feel like a blend of true inspiration from everyone involved, but also, I have to imagine, a lot of happy accidents in that the tone just comes together the way it does. Because this is the other thing, this is a three-parter, and I don't think I've ever seen a Doctor Who three-parter before. Yeah. I think there's some in, like, the first Doctor era or something. But
yes,
like,
there's a couple, but, like, those were tended to be made because it's like, oh, we've got this weird production gap, like, fuck it, let's throw Edge of Destruction together or something.
Yeah, and it's extremely well-paced, but what's interesting about it is that it feels like, I can imagine what the four-episode version of this would look like. It would look like, I think, a fourth Doctor Robert Holmes era kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it plays like that. Like, if you took Pyramids of Mars, made it weirder, made the Doctor scarier, and then played it all on fast forward, and just skipped through, like, most of what the exposition would be, that's Ghostlight. And it is this, it's just an utterly unique Doctor Who experience. I've never seen a Doctor Who story that feels like this one. And, you know, there's a lot of Doctor Who stories. That's saying something.
Yeah, it's one of the things I love about the Seventh Doctor era, particularly these last three stories, is all of them feel, like, completely different. And, like, I've never quite seen a Doctor Who story that does this shit before. This is pretty crazy.
So
all that stuff, like, all, like, the bigger ideas and the bigger sort of, like, main plot things, I think, are awesome. And, like even if they don't make sense, they're extremely entertaining. And, like, I feel like every time I rewatch it, I, like, put together another, like, two things of, like, oh, shit, I didn't quite think of that before. But then also I think there is that core, strong, like, pair of performances between Sylvester McCoy and Sophie Aldred at the heart of the story, and that, like, element of the Doctor manipulating people, like even so far as before this, the episode has even started, a manipulation has occurred that, like, the Doctor and AC are not here on accident. Like, it's this, like, surprise he has for her. That's not a very nice surprise. It's like, surprise, I brought you to the source of a deep-seated trauma from your childhood, Ace. Like, happy birthday!
It really does. You see shades here of I have to imagine the Seventh Doctor was some kind of inspiration for Stephen Moffat on how he characterizes some of Peter Capaldi.
Yeah.
Because it feels like if you were doing the Sylvester McCoy stuff today, you would do a lot of what they wound up doing with Peter Capaldi, of having him in this interesting direction where he, like, Capaldi is less Machiavellian, but he does push people to extreme places.
Yes.
Like, definitely the episode Listen is probably the closest you come to a Ghostlight in modern Doctor Who, in terms of how weird it pushes things and how the Doctor is not at all forthcoming with the people around him about what his plans are.
And at times just is, like, downright unlikable. Like, they put him in situations where you're like, he's not like this very kind grandfatherly figure all the time. Like, there are, like, some of those really dark scenes between him and Ace, like, make me uncomfortable still. Like, I've seen them a couple of times, and, like, the way he pushes and pokes and prods her into, like, exploring her traumas is like, this doesn't feel super healthy, but, like, it feels appropriate for the character to do that.
And God, there are just some electric scenes between the two of them.
Yeah.
Because this is something we've been away from for a while in our Doctor Who monthly wanderings, is a really good companion-doctor relationship.
Yeah.
You know, the last one would probably be, you know, like in City of Death, you have the Doctor and
Romana.
Romana. But, like, you know, the Doctor and whoever the fuck is in Kinda, who cares?
Tegan.
Yeah.
Adric's
there.
And Nyssa is there at the very beginning of part one and the very end of part four.
Yes.
So Sarah Sutton was technically in Kinda.
Yeah, but, like, they don't matter. He's not even with them in that episode. And then Perry, whatever, you know, in Vengeance on Pharos, and that's probably the
Perpigilliam Brown, please use your proper American name, Perpigilliam.
Ms. Perpigilliam Brown, in probably her best appearance on Doctor Who and Vengeance. Well, no, she's in Caves of Androzani, so that's what you mean.
Yeah.
But yes, anyway, best appearance with the Sixth Doctor. And yeah, but now we get this, and it's like, okay, this is the real deal. This is real Doctor Companion stuff, because the scene in part one where they're by the staircase and she has put it together like, I know where we are. I was here in 1983.
Yeah. This is Perivale, which is like it has more impact if you've seen other Ace stuff, because you know that's her hometown. But it's still like, there's something about the way she delivers that line and just like shouts it at the Doctor. It's like, you motherfucker, this is Perivale. You brought me back here.
Yes, it's... Oh my god, it's like a heart stopper of a sequence, which I did have to rewind and rewatch with subtitles because I didn't know what she meant by Perivale. I'm like, okay, it's the name of the town.
Yeah.
But yes, so that's great in part three when she talks about how I burned the place down and she has that whole revelation. I mean, my god, there is some powerful stuff here. And I want to talk about Ace, Sean, because you have said on this podcast that Ace is your favorite Doctor Who companion.
Yeah, I think she's like up there, if not my favorite. Yeah.
Okay. Why? Let's talk about it.
Oh man, it's just, she's so unique, like, and it's like that relationship and the chemistry between her and Sylvester McCoy is so different than anything that came before it, and I think, and is like very much the model of a bunch of modern Doctor Who companions. Like, a lot of modern Doctor Who companions feel like a blend of Sarah Jane and in terms of like kind of like their position in the society that they're pulled from and their general like sort of like likability and humor and stuff, but with a bit more of the like character exploration stuff that they do with Ace. But the stuff I love about Ace is she's just this fucking punk girl who is pulled from from a different background, because she's from a working class background. She's a dropout, like from like high school or secondary school dropout. Like, you know, she's comes from this really rough neighborhood. She was involved in gangs. Like, she had a bad history, and she's kind of picked up in this really weird way where she. I forget what the whole fucking explanation of how she ends up in space, because she like, he doesn't pick her up from 1980s London. She is a waitress in a like bar in space on a planet called Dragonfire, who got like picked up by Sabalom Glitz, who is a character from Mysterious Planet, a Sixth Doctor story.
So they basically, that sounds like Douglas Adams wrote her introduction.
It basically,
that's
kind
totally
of,
a Hitchhiker's Guide kind
yes,
of thing.
It does feel like that, and she's like this sort of weird sort of like wayward soul, and I forget like how the fuck she ends up on Dragonfire. It's some weird explanation, but yeah, but the Mel ends up staying behind because it's like, well, it's time to go, Mel. It's been a very unusual time. I hope you enjoy your carrot juice. It's time to wave goodbye to you. And then they welcome Ace on board, and then from there on, you know, the role that Ace has in those stories is so much more active than most other companions. I mean, her first full story, the one after Dragonfire, the beginning of season 25 is Remembrance of the Daleks, a story which has her beat the shit out of Dalek with a baseball bat and blow one up with, like, improvised explosives. She has, like, she's not sort of, like, school smart, except for she knows her basic chemistry enough to be able to make chemical explosives
and on Sean, the fly. Speaking of that, I'm looking at the plot synopsis for Dragonfire.
Yes.
She becomes friends with Ace, a young woman who turns out to have actually come from 20th century Earth. Propelled forward in time by a mysterious ice or time storm appeared in her bedroom while she was trying to experiment with Nitro 9, an explosive of her own creation.
Yes.
Yes.
So there you go. That's why Ace is my favorite.
She literally chemistried herself into the future.
Yes. It's so great, and yeah, her relationship with the doctor. I mean, one thing I love is that she calls the doctor professor. That's something just, like, immediately incredibly charming about that to me.
They definitely, of all the, like, doctor companions we've seen, other than maybe Joe Grant, I think has the most modern feeling, like, doctor companion rapport.
Yeah.
Just, like, the back and forth they have is, like, super feels like Dr. Clara or Dr. Amy or something.
Yeah, the Ace doesn't take the doctor's shit, you know?
Yeah.
Like she is willing to yell at the doctor, willing to fight with the doctor. She also has, you know, she has a bit of that Leela-esque, like, violence to her. That's,
yes.
I always appreciate when the companion is the one in the like willing to sort of go to violence at the situation. I think it puts the doctor in an interesting role sometimes, particularly when your doctor is also one that's willing to orchestrate the destruction of entire planet like Skaro. The Seventh Doctor does some fucked up shit. He also, at the end of Remembrance of the Daleks, convinces the last remaining Dalek on Earth to kill itself. It goes places.
I'm very excited to get to the Seventh Doctor.
Yeah,
and it's good.
So good.
The Seventh Doctor is the carrot at the end of the stick that is the Fifth and Sixth Doctors.
It really is. It is like the carrot at the end of the stick of the 80s Doctor Who. And
yeah.
It's just like, I think I love the opening. I mean,
oh, we haven't talked about it, though.
Yeah, we didn't even address the fucking, like, opening face wink that Sylvester McCoy gives.
It tells you everything you need to know about the Seventh Doctor, really.
Yes.
It's that little wink and smile, and it is a two-frame... And it's like, clearly they had the CGI to do more than a two-frame animation for him, but no. Two frames, fade, wink, smile,
yeah.
Perfect. That crazy CGI opening, which... If you haven't seen it, like it's like the low rent 80s version of that brief theme song Matt Smith had
yes.
at the end of his run. That's like the big budget version of what they did for McCoy. But I love it. I also love that it ends with the what looks like the logo for like the Doctor Who children's spinoff, where it's handwritten Doctor Big Who.
It looks like something from like Reading Rainbow or something.
Yes.
It's like very much that period or like Magic School Bus. It's that kind of like late 80s, early 90s aesthetic on the
yeah.
logo and everything.
Which is funny because this is not a very kid-friendly era of Doctor Who.
No.
But yeah, he is not the cuddliest Doctor. But no, they do that. And then I always love that they have the title of the episode and the writer right under that. Like again, it's very 80s like school child kind of thing, you know, or after school special sort of thing, but
yeah.
It's fun. It's a great mix of the theme song. The audio in this whole era, they've come into their own, I think, the John Nathan Turner, like, stable of composers.
Yeah.
You know, this serial is Mark Ayers, who you hear a lot in Doctor Who Today, because he's a member of the Doctor Who restoration team. He helped with a lot of the DVDs. He did, like, 5.1 mixes for a lot of the DVDs, including Ghostlight. I didn't listen to that. Because I'm kind of a mono purist, but if I watch it again, I might experiment with that, because that's cool that they did that. But he was the composer for this, too, and it's got a great score.
Yeah, and he also did The Greatest Show in the Galaxy and The Curse of Fenric, two other really
nice.
Good Seventh Doctor stories. So he's
recently, he did the score for Shada when they did the completion
right.
of that, and it's great. He's doing it more in a Dudley Simpson style on purpose, but it's like, he's a very good Doctor Who composer.
Yeah, and it's just like generally this era of the show feels like it is pulling together like this style. It's got great performances from both of its leads, then like a really good direction for both of its leads. It's got a great script editor. They've got a good cast of like stable of other people, like new writers. It's a lot of fresh, like strong, fresh blood in writers, good directors, like some great new composers. The writer for Ghostlight, I should mention before I forget about it, is Mark Platt, who this is the first and it is the only televised Doctor Who story he wrote, but he is very, like, sort of prodigious in the spin-offs, and he does several Big Finish audios. Notably, he wrote Spare Parts, probably most notably the Fifth Doctor story that deals with the origin of the Cybermen, which is one of the best early Big Finish stories. So he's done a bunch of Big Finish. He's done all kinds of nonsense. So he's great. And it's like really impressive to me that Ghostlight is his like first. I was gonna say credit.
Ghostlight sounds like the kind of thing you do on your way out the door when you're like, I'm leaving, I'm gonna burn the house down.
Yeah.
But no, this is what he started on Doctor Who with. That is insane.
Yeah, so yeah, it's just like the people behind the scenes were clearly like really committed, other than Jonathan Powell and the others at the BBC who wanted to kill the show, but everyone like actually making the show. Like, we're really, really committed to exploring this new space, and Ghostlight is, in my opinion, is basically the pinnacle of that because of how it blends this, like, weird aesthetic with this really dark drama between the Doctor and the Companion, and then these, like, surprisingly complicated, like, science fiction themes dealing with evolution and change.
Yes, and actually, I want to talk about the production side of it for a second longer, because the other thing is, Ghostlight is really well directed and shot.
Yes.
It has great atmosphere, production design. It just looked like... It's actually one of those that, like, if this were shot on, like, actual film or HD video or something, it wouldn't look as good because it on, like, the beta tape thing where all the lights kind of shimmer and, like, ghost across the screen, it just adds to the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Do you have the name of the director there?
I can find it. It is Alan Waring.
Yeah, just want to credit because it is a very well-directed episode. And it's not that I think they got some kind of big cash infusion and got a huger budget here than they had in the last couple stories we've talked about. But, like, you know, the Colin Baker era looks very low rent. You know, it looks like they shot it on a porn studio after hours. And Ghostlight, it's not that I think they had more to work with. I just think they found a way to, like... Because this is, like, just one kind of big set for this. It's a couple of rooms in a mansion, you know? But they really make the most of it. It really feels like they studied what was being done back in the Fourth Doctor era or something with the best, like, Doctor Who gothic horror stuff. And they really make it work. It is a really dynamic story to watch. It just makes great use of those muted, like, gray-brown colors in the space. It is visually quite creepy. The costuming and makeup for the characters is absolutely fantastic, especially on Josiah.
Yeah.
And just it does a lot of, like, little visual tricks that are very frightening in the way low-rent horror can be. Like, there's a scene where the Doctor comes into that one room where everyone is under a sheet, and, like, first he pulls it off and Josiah is, like, frozen under the sheet.
Yeah.
And then Gwendolyn and all the other people in the room are just, like, under these sheets. Like, they're not statues yet, but they're just not moving. It's very creepy. There's
or, a lot of like, things that part at the beginning of part one where I feel like you start to get a sense of, like, oh, there's something, like, really offbeat here is when all the maids in the manor, like, rush out. It's like, nobody wants to be in here after six, and they leave, and the clock starts going, and those two panels just fall out, and this, like, battalion of Victorian maids just, like, march out from inside the walls. You're like, what the fuck? It's, like, really, yeah, like, some of the imagery is really offsetting. I think a lot of the blocking of the actors is also really interesting in some scenes. It's one of those things that make the scenes between the Doctor and Ace that they have, like, these really dark conversations in part one and part two that, like, are, like, lit really interestingly, and the way that they're positioned is, it kind of reminds me of, like, some of the stuff they would do in old Japanese movies or, like, Zatoichi movies and stuff like that. That's, like, no two people have ever stood in a room talking, like, standing at these weird angles and, like facing these directions. But cinematically, it's really powerful. And it communicates a lot about their relationship. Just, like, you seeing the dot, like Ace really close in the frame, kind of huddled down. And the Doctor kind of, like, right behind her, over her, like, coming in closer. It's that kind of stuff really pushes those scenes over the edge.
It's just well directed, you know. It's got good ideas. It executes on those ideas very well, and it is consistently engaging to watch. There's not a slow moment in this one.
Yeah, and I think that is like the stuff that makes Ghostlight as remarkable as it is that it's not just like the writing and the dialogue. It's not just the performances. It's not just the direction. It's like all of those things are working so well, and I think, like, there's a very easy world in which this script produces a fucking terrible Doctor Who story.
Yes.
But when it's made with this care and with these performances and this direction, like, it just fucking sings, and I think it's wonderful.
Yeah. So, what are some other... We could talk about some of the characters. We haven't talked about McCoy yet. Do you want to talk about some scenes? Where do you want to go with this next?
I don't know. Where do you want to go, Jonathan? What are you feeling?
Oh, boy. Let's talk about the general premise of this one.
Okay, yeah.
We'll play this game. You know what? Here, we'll play the game of I will try to explain the plot to you.
Okay.
And good, then you will explain the plot to the best of your ability, which is much better than I can.
Yes, I think I've got a pretty solid foundation on the general plot.
Okay. So I think what happened in Ghostlight, and I want to stress too, I don't care if I know what happened in Ghostlight. Yes. It's the kind of weird where it just carries you along. It is really engaging. I think its themes and ideas come through even if the plot doesn't. And that is a special skill to have when doing the weirder side of things. And that's great.
100%.
Yeah, like, you know, I will say, like, I couldn't tell you what happened in Kinda at all. I'm not sure if I can tell you more of what happened in Ghostlight. I just know I got more out of it, if we're making that particular comparison. All right. But, okay, haunted house, seemingly. Some very weird stuff is going on. There's an old dude named Josiah who wants to become the guy who looks like John C. Reilly.
Yeah.
Who wants to become the Emperor of England and expand England's colonial outreach. Is that somewhat correct?
Okay. Yes, that is ultimately, at the end of part three, that is revealed to have been his plot, is to assassinate Queen Victoria.
Yes. Yeah, I definitely got that because it was wacky enough.
Yeah. Well, because they have the portrait of Queen Victoria. This is one of, like, the great bits of direction in like set design, is they have that portrait of Queen Victoria over the fireplace in part one.
Yes.
And then over the course of the three parts, you see it gets moved, like a like this bullseye looking like darts game thing gets drawn on it with points, and then eventually you have like Josiah like has it held out with like the bullseyes and like holes poked in, is like, we're gonna kill Queen Victoria.
Yes.
It's really like that portrait and the deterioration of that portrait marks like the descent of madness over the course of this plot, as you like sort of start to get a sense of what Smith is trying to do.
So Josiah has some weird powers, I think. Okay, I'm not sure what all those powers are. He's able to freeze people in time because there's a constable in the episode, a police officer who is in a drawer.
Yeah, who's been in the drawer for like 3 years. Yeah.
Yes. Josiah, I think, is trying to like de-age himself. They talk about him, he's evolving into a proper Victorian gentleman.
Yes.
I don't know if that's supposed to be literally he is evolving, or he is like able to like change his form and become closer and closer to the mark of what he wants to be. But that is what he is trying to do. To do that, this is a gap. I'm not sure what he's doing to do that. He has some people in the mansion with him. Like, I think one of their names is Gwendolyn, is the young woman.
Yes.
And an older woman there. And I'm not sure what role they play. I do know eventually we find out that Josiah is some kind of space alien who came in a craft with the ethereal being's light, who we talked about, and Control, who we didn't talk about, who is like a weird, sad
mad woman in the attic.
Mad woman in the attic. And
she is a ladylike, excuse
lady,
me.
Yes. he escaped the ship crash, but they were trapped in it, but he's using their powers to do something. This is where it kind of breaks down for me.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, because of the Doctor's machinations, Light and Control are released. Now, Light has plans. He does not like that humanity evolves, and he wants to stop their evolution. But, of course, that is in contrast to what Josiah is trying to do. Control is doing something over here, and I never figured that out, but it was fucking hilarious.
Okay, yes.
And finally, the Doctor burns Josiah's invitation to see Queen Victoria. Fairly flimsy plan when you think about it on the whole. And so he's not able to do that, and he's sad. And then they thought Control the ship away, and then he basically does a thing where he logics Light out of existence, and then he and Ace have a fun final conversation and leave.
Okay, that
it really breaks down along the way. Yeah, my understanding
that is, I think, probably about the synopsis I would have been able to provide after my first viewing of Ghostlight. So I think you're in a good spot. So this is, to the best of my ability, what the full plot of Ghostlight is. This, I'm not going to try to present it in like the order that the information is presented, because that makes it way more confusing. So, thousands of years ago, at the time of the Neanderthals and everything, which is where the butler named Nimrod comes from, who's a really great character. But like during that period in Earth's history, this ethereal being named Light came to Earth and conducted a survey of the life on Earth. And that's where he takes Nimrod as a sample of the Neanderthals, and he takes all these other samples. And as a way to sort of perform that survey, he has two entities with him. Control, who is named Control because I think she's supposed to be some sort of like control, like scientific control in the survey. I don't know entirely what that's supposed to actually mean, but like, because I don't know the full extent of like what they mean when they take that survey. But that's what basically what Control is. Is she is another like sort of like a weird sort of experimental thing used to sort of like catalog the life on Earth. And then Josiah Smith is also one of those beings, and his role is he as far as I can understand, he starts to evolve into different life creature, like Earth, like life forms on Earth, for reasons I don't fully understand. Like, but that has to do with something that Light needs to do to perform the survey. Josiah is this entity that helps him with that, that evolves continually. And I think Control is basically supposed to never evolve, and that's one of the things that's interesting, is that she does begin to change over the course of the story. So then eventually Light leaves, catalogs all of the life forms on Earth. He leaves for reasons that I think are ultimately basically unexplained. Light ends up coming back to Earth while he's in hibernation, and the ship lands back on Earth, in Victorian London. And so then Survey, who is, or Smith, Josiah, is still around, and he's awake, but Light is in hibernation. So he decides, I want to live, I want to have this life, I want to do this stuff, I want to have this power, I want to do all this shit. So he takes over this whole mansion, the Pritchard Mansion, or it's got, what the fuck is the name of the place? It's got this weird name. You can look that up while I'm thinking about it. But so they take her, Gabriel Chase. Called Gabriel Chase, which I don't, that's a weird name for a mansion, but he takes over this Victorian manor. He takes over the people, the Pritchards, that are living there, which is Gwendolyn is the daughter. Mr. Pritchard is killed or sent to Java, which is what they say when they kill someone or they catalog someone, is they go to the island of Java. And then Mrs. Pritchard is the head butler or maid lady, who she has lost her memory. Gwendolyn has lost her memory because Smith Josiah has access to the technology of the magic thought ship, and so he's able to control all these people. And he has, you're saying, he kind of controls time in some weird way, but he has evolved, his current form when we encounter him is bad with light, so actual literal physical light, also on top of obviously metaphorically the being named Light. So he has the weird little John C. Reilly glasses and can't go out until after 6 o'clock, and that's when all of his time control people also come out and run the manor. And so he has this whole plot that because he wants to live his life and have power, and there's also all this stuff thematically that's happening of juxtaposing the evolution of species with the evolution of culture, which is a whole Victorian thing that we'll talk about more. But he thinks I can lead humanity to the pinnacle of its state. And so he is both literally physically evolving more into a human. He's also evolving more into a quote unquote Victorian gentleman. And he wants to evolve into an emperor to rule the world and make the whole Atlas pink, as the Doctor refers to it. So to do that, he has captured a big game, an African big game hunter. I mean, an English big game hunter that hunts big game in Africa, who is named Redvers Van Cooper, which is great. That's where the plot starts, is with this weird guy, and the Doctor and Ace find that RFC cigar case or whatever the fuck it is that is radioactive. And he has basically driven Redvers Van Cooper insane, because Redvers Van Cooper has an invitation to go to Buckingham Palace and meet Queen Victoria, so that Josiah Smith wants to use that invitation to be able to carry out his assassination plan. But ultimately, Redvers Van Cooper doesn't really regain his sanity. I guess he kind of falls in love with Control and decides to burn the thing. That's what you're talking about. The invitation eventually gets burned in the fire, which makes Josiah Smith very, very pissed off. Over the course of all of this, the Doctor and Ace have been doing their investigation. Ace obviously has her whole weird past where in 100 years in the future from when we're seeing this, she has burned the mansion down after her apartment or her friend's apartment that she was staying at got firebombed by neo-Nazis, and so she left there, jumped over the fence into this house, felt an evil presence, and burned it down. So the Doctor's trying to get her to face her trauma and her past, and trying to figure out why did she burn this place down. The reason is because there was the eternal being named Light, who is living in the basement with Control, that has now awoken from his hibernation at this point in the plot. And Control has also escaped and come up, and Light has come out here, and he's like, where the fuck am I? What the fuck's going on here? Am I on Earth? This can't be Earth. And he's like, I conducted this entire survey. I cataloged every species on this planet, and they're still changing and they're still evolving, and he can't understand the concept of evolution and change, and he's frustrated that nothing can be static, because he wants to be able to take this survey and understand everything about the life on Earth, and he can't do that if he does that whole thing where he's like, even these microbes floating in the air are evolving as we speak. And so he's like, I want everything to change. And the Doctor's like, well, that would mean the destruction of all life on Earth, and that's crazy. But it's like, Light has enough power to do that. So then that's when the Doctor, as you said, Control and a lot of those people escape in the thought ship, and the Doctor confuses his Machiavellian and logic and manipulation skills to convince Light that Light himself is a being that is constantly changing and evolving, and his thoughts and his positions and his feelings on things are changing as Light is speaking, and therefore Light is himself a part of the problem that he's trying to solve. So then Light dissolves himself, and then his will is absorbed into the fabric and like the literal building of that house, so that in 100 years, Ace feels and senses that evil intent of Light that is still physically present in the house and burns it down to the ground, thus creating a closed loop that is the episode of Ghost Light.
Sean, if you had like told me that whole synopsis and I had not seen Ghost Light, and you finished saying it and said, "Now, Jonathan, guess how many episodes is Ghost Light?" I would have said, "Oh, that's a 6-parter, right? That's a 6-parter. 8-parter. No, this is 3 fucking episodes.
It's 1 episode shorter than the norm."
Yes, it's shorter than the norm. They fit a lot into these 3 episodes.
Yeah, like obviously a lot of some of that stuff is like supposition of like things that are sort of implied, and you kind of have to like fill in some gaps. Like I think particularly the nature of what exactly Josiah Smith is and what Control are is like a little bit sort of like vague in the story, but that's one of the things I like, is that it makes them feel like archetypal in ways that in a way that's really fun and I kind of dig.
Yes, absolutely. So we've talked about most of the major. I mean, we talked about Josiah Smith, Light. I mean, we haven't mentioned his whole getup. He looks. It's an amazing costume and effect they have on him.
It's so good. He's got like this full like kind of gold body paint in like this big cape and like these flowing clothes, and his like hair is this great like kind of curly hair. He has this, I love his like, "I'm Light. Hello, everybody." He's got this very sort of like monotone, very pleasant voice that is kind of like unsettling, particularly when he starts killing people or when he has turned a bunch of the maids into primordial soup, like literally primordial
soup. That scene is amazing.
Yeah, so the doctor's like, "Ace, don't eat the soup."
That is the payoff to that, of that whole scene of the doctor coming into the room and saying, "Don't eat the soup." And it's like 5 minutes before that's paid off. And when it comes back around, it's so good.
Yeah, that's great. Also, there's that great scene that, like, I can't believe they fucking got this on television, where I think it's Nimrod that walks into a room and sees Light is there with, like, Light is standing with his back to, like, the camera and turns around, and he's holding, like, an arm. He's just said,
"Oh, right.
I was curious about how it functions, so I decided to dismantle it." And it's like, he just sort of like, because there's also an earlier scene that kind of sets it up where I think he kind of like asks a maid to come with him, and then the next time you see him, he has taken this person apart, and you don't see the body, but you 100% see this like disembodied arm with like a bloody stump at the end. And it's like, you know, it's a 1980s like Doctor Who prop, so it doesn't look super realistic. But if you think about kind of like what we talked about with Brain of Morbius and like the brain and like getting shot in that episode, if you think about how modern Doctor Who would do that, and if they had that there, that would be the most gruesome shit you'd ever seen in like a program that is supposed to be watched by children.
It wouldn't. I mean, it wouldn't happen. Today. Yeah, it wouldn't, there's no way it would make it on here.
It's like so. It's so, because it's like, it's visually pretty gross, but then like the implication of what happened there is like utterly disgusting. So yeah, Light is, I think, just a great character that is really well realized.
Who's only in episode 3. Yeah. Like, that's the craziest thing. Episode 3 is one of the most eventful 20 minutes of Doctor Who you'll ever see.
Yeah, it feels like, part 3 feels like it's an entire Doctor Who serial somehow.
Yes, well, because, like, the main villain is introduced. Like, they hold on. It's kind of, honestly, it is somewhat comparable to Pyramids of Mars in that you don't get Sutek in Pyramids of Mars until part 4.
But, but there are people constantly talking about him before you get there, so that, like, once that villain is introduced, there's so much impact, particularly like you said, like that cliffhanger part 2. It's like Light, and then this Light fills the room, and I think that's the cliffhanger. It's like, it's a really great setup for that character.
Yeah, although it's different than Pyramids of Mars, because Sutek we know is a being. The Doctor just yelling Light, we have no fucking clue what he's talking about.
Sure, yes. It's, on your first viewing.
On your first viewing, no, it's great. My main comment I want to make about Light is that he looks like what would happen if David Lynch was cast as a Doctor Who villain.
Yes, he 100%. So looks like a younger like David Lynch of the late 80s. Like, legitimately looks like that.
Yes, and I just, again, if Doctor Who wants to do a remake of Ghost Light, John C. Reilly as Josiah, David Lynch as Light.
Also, while he's there, fucking who better to direct a remake of Ghost Light than David Lynch? Because like, this is one of, if not the most Lynchian Doctor Who episodes there are.
Yes. Just get them, you know, Sylvester McCoy and Sophie Aldred can reprise their roles.
Yes.
And then, I don't know, you could have some fun with the other parts as well. But yes, It's a thing. Light is an interesting villain, to say the least. He's, like, painted gold, and then later he's painted gray.
Yes, yeah, when he's turned evil, he's, like, grayish-black. Yeah.
It's, this episode, man, it's all kind of blurs in my head. Because I had totally forgotten about the arm scene, even though when I saw it, I think I literally, like, gasped. Like,
yeah.
Oh, wow, they're doing this.
Yes, it's amazing. Also, I don't want to forget that Carl Forjoon as Nimrod is fucking awesome. The weird butler,
definitely
caveman.
Feels a little bit like a, I don't know, successor to the character from Brain of Morbius. Kato is his name.
Yes, yeah.
A little bit kind of in that vein, but he's more intelligent.
Yeah, I think that's the thing I love about him so much is that you think he's just supposed to be because he looks like he's a caveman. He looks like he's a Neanderthal. It's like that kind of stereotypical makeup. But he's like one of the most intelligent, if not maybe the most intelligent, not doctor character in the whole story.
Yes,
it's like I love when the doctor presents him with this like bear tooth. And it's like the tooth of like the ice. Bear, it's like it conveys great value and wisdom in my culture. It's like okay, because that's before you even know he's a Neanderthal is when that happens. So you know when that's revealed later, you know the fucking Seventh Doctor saw that dude and immediately understood what he was. Found it, like took a bear claw or something off of one of the stuffed bears in the manor and gave it to this dude so that the guy would start respecting the Doctor. Like that's fucking like when you have seen this story and you rewatch it, there are so many little things that happen that build up to these like reveals that the Doctor is already catching on to well before the audience can even be made aware of it. It's really awesome.
Well, let's talk about that. The Seventh Doctor.
Yes.
Sylvester McCoy. He is just so good. And this feels like this story is the Seventh Doctor's id made manifest.
Yes.
Because he is so far ahead. This is like, he is clearly one of the most like piercingly intelligent incarnations of the Doctor, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
He's never, like, a step behind. He is very, you know, scheming. He is kind of conniving. He is not forthcoming with his companions. But he is also warm and funny and interesting. Like, he really does... I don't know if I'm... He feels like Tom Baker and Peter Capaldi's Doctors were, like, mashed up in some weird way.
Yeah.
If I'm trying to draw comparisons. Because he is also, like, one of the most different Doctors. Like, of the original seven, he might be the furthest afield. Yeah, other than, like, a William Hartnell, who's, you know, the first one and is very different. But, like, he really feels different. And it is so... Just every time I see a Sylvester McCoy episode, it's exciting to watch him work. Because it doesn't feel like he's working with any kind of net of what the Doctor is supposed to be. He really is. And I think this is what you were talking about earlier. This was something Andrew Cartmell was trying to do, was remake what does the Doctor look and feel and sound like.
Yeah.
You know, and even some of the mythos around that. And it feels like McCoy was really set loose to very much do his own thing with the character. He is not hamstrung in the ways a Colin Baker was by the writer. He really can go far with it. And he's a joy to watch. And some of the writing in this episode and the lines he has, it's both that some of the dialogue is amazing.
Yeah.
But the way he delivers it, and there's one exchange in particular. It's in the scene when Ace confronts the Doctor about bringing her back to this evil mansion. I just want to read a couple lines from this, building to one of my favorite line deliveries in all of Doctor Who. It's, the Doctor says, "You were 13, you climbed over the wall for a dare. That's your surprise, isn't it, bringing me back here? Remind me what it was when you sent that you sensed when you entered this deserted house, an aura of intense evil. Don't you have things you hate? And here it is. I can't stand burnt toast. I loathe bus stations, terrible places, full of lost luggage and lost souls."
Yeah.
And the way he, like, wraps his mouth around those words, lost luggage and lost souls, like, and his, like, eyes just go kind of into a glaze for a second. Like, he isn't throwing that out. He's thinking about an experience he's had at a bus station, like a space bus station where everyone was very depressed. It is an amazing little moment. And it's just pieces like that where the writing is both very good and the Doctor comes back, or Sylvester McCoy comes to the writing with just these amazing deliveries. And there's more just from that sequence. It's all amazing.
Yeah, they give him, like this episode in particular, they give him all this like really juicy stuff to play. He is at probably his most manipulative here. But he also can be very funny. He kind of can bounce off the wall in different ways. He definitely has that like strange physical presence. Like, it is one of my favorite things about McCoy as the Doctor is he's, like, both... Because he's, like, a short guy. He's probably the shortest actor to have played the Doctor. He's, like, pretty diminutive. But And so sometimes he can use that in this, like, very clownish way. Like, there are some episodes, like The Greatest Show in the Galaxy, where he's literally doing magic tricks to, like, impress Norse gods so that they don't destroy everything. So it's like, there are times where he's, like, very physically clownish. But then also, he is able to command a room physically with his presence so well, even though he's small. And in some ways, like, because he's small, he stands out really well. And he's just able to use that physical presence to control what's going on the scene in so many ways. And one of my favorite lines that he gets is a smaller one that's near the end of part three, where everything is going completely batshit. Everything is flying out of control, and the Doctor just has this one little line when he's talking to Redvers near the end, where he says, "Oh, things are getting out of control. Even I can't play this many games at once." It's just like, because there's so many threads going on. But yeah, he has so many brilliant scenes, so many brilliant turns. He fucking rocks that costume so much. It was something else we were talking about before we were recording, is that since this is from his last season, in his last season they gave him this dark brown jacket instead of the very like light brown jacket he had for his first two seasons. And I think he just has this very sharp look with that like the darkness. And I think it particularly looks good in this story because it fits the dark Victorian manner and a lot of the lighting they have. It really, like, he stands out and makes him look very severe in a way that is, like, different for the Doctor. Like, it's a far cry from, like, the Technicolor dream coat of Colin Baker, you know?
That said, it's amazing you can say he looks severe when he is wearing a sweater in every shot that has dozens of question marks on it.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
I mean, like, John Nathan Turner was like, after the fourth Doctor's one season, he's like, not enough question marks, get more. And the fifth Doctor has them on his lapels, and he's like, not enough. Sixth Doctor, Technicolor dream coat and lots of question marks, still not enough. I need them all over his sweater. They need to be in every shot, and he needs to carry an umbrella, like the Riddler's fucking umbrella with a red question mark on the end. And here's the thing, Sylvester McCoy rocks it. He makes it feel like... Like, I don't really ever believe that the Sixth Doctor would choose to dress himself that way. I very much believe this incarnation of the Doctor would dress himself that way because there's just something about how McCoy wears it, how it relates to his like physical stature in the frame, the color scheme around him. It is very, and I do think that the darker brown coat kind of helps tie it together. But it is an amazing costume and use of the costume.
Yeah. And then you have, I think, like, other than the two big Dr. Ace scenes, you have that my favorite scene with him is the dining room scene in part three that we kind of talked about a little bit, where he comes in, immediately tells Ace, don't eat the soup. And then, like, because that's where all the shit with, like, the Queen Victoria stuff happens. He breaks the spell on Gwendolyn and Mrs. Pritchard by giving them they already did Gwendolyn, but he gives Mrs. Pritchard the locket with her own picture in it that allows her to sort of, like, reattain her identity. And so he like releases her. He's sort of like fucking around with Josiah. Control and Redvers have kind of like started this weird relationship because Control, we have to talk about her character more in full, but she has like kind of become this like weird sort of almost proper Victorian lady. Then Light comes in, or Light is there, and he has the whole soup. And then there's this great exchange between Doctor and the Light here of where finally the Doctor has decided he's going to sort of expose everything that is happening here. And so he says, because this is already, they've revealed, so the Doctor says, so you started with Inspector McKenzie, and Josiah says, the cream of Scotland Yard. This is like, so Inspector McKenzie has already been turned into, as the Doctor says, primordial soup, the most precious substance in the universe from which all life springs. And Light says, merely sugars, proteins, and amino acids, but it will soon start to evolve again, so I'm going to stop the change here. All organic life will be eradicated in the firestorm, and when this world is destroyed, no more change, no more evolution, no more life, no more amendments to my catalog. And the Doctor says, but you evolve too, Light. Nonsense. Of course you do. You change, adapt all the time. Your attitude, your place, your mind. I mean, look at you now. You're no longer your original shape, and I don't think much about your catalog. It's full of gaps. All organic life is recorded. What about the griffins, the basilisks? You miss the dragons, the bandersnatches. Then there are the slithy toves and the crowned Saxe-Coburg.
Yeah, and here's something that's happening in that scene.
Yes.
Is in the middle of that last line you're reading, he moves from the dining room to the entrance hall.
Yes.
Just like leaving. It's actually, there's a lot of very theatrical direction to this episode. It's like he's moving across the stage. And he just knows the guy he's in conversation with can transport wherever he wants. So the Doctor, just in this fucking power move, is just like, I'm changing the setting of this debate. And he walks away until he, like, bumps into light again. It's an amazing, like, staging there.
Yeah, and then that comes up again, because then when the Doctor returns to talking to light, he basically says, like, as another proof of that, he's changed. It's like, you've changed your, like, location, too. Like, yes. You're constantly changing in ways you're not accounting for.
Yeah, everything he's doing is very crafty. He is making, he's laying a plan, even if just he's, you know, moving to another room.
Yes.
It's very interesting to watch.
Yeah, and it's something where that's in the writing, but it's also so much in the performance of just, like, he owns that so much. And when he decides to go and he decides to start giving these speeches, I think Sylvester McCoy has just some of the best fucking speeches in all of classic Doctor Who, of being able to just, like, say, like, okay, motherfucker, like, it's time to wrap all this shit up. And I'm like, again, this is a dude that convinced a Dalek to commit suicide. Like that's the kind of, like, the character that he's playing, but it's also, like, the actor very much inspired that, because that was not the way the character was written in McCoy's first season. It was after they saw how good he could be in moments like that, that they really leaned into his characterization.
It's awesome. He is so fun to watch. Can we read one more piece of dialogue together?
Sure,
yeah. You've got the same transcript I do. Last conversation, just at the very end.
Okay, yeah.
The last scene of the episode is so good. You read the Doctor, I'll read Ace. Okay. Some of the writing in here is just so good. I have to do it.
He's dispersed.
Forever?
The house will remember. Just the ghost of an evil memory lingering. A dark secret after the candle is out.
I felt it in here 100 years' time.
An evil older than time itself.
So I burnt the house down.
Any regrets?
Yes.
Yes?
I wish I'd blown it up instead.
Wicked.
That is a great piece of Doctor Who writing.
Yeah, I particularly love that the last line of the episode is from the Doctor. He just says, wicked. That's the most late 80s thing ever written in Doctor Who.
It's so late 80s, but again, it's one of those moments of, like, the Doctor and Ace and you know, Sylvester McCoy and Sophie Aldred are on such a fucking wavelength together that they can have that kind of just crackerjack conversation. Like, it reminds me of, like, a lot of the Dr. Clara conversations you get in season 9.
Absolutely.
Where, like, at the end, the TARDIS at the end, and they would just know the exact right, you know, duet to end the episode on. This is one of those.
Yeah, because, like, these actors and these characters have been together for, like, a full year, you know? Yeah. So, yeah, like, particularly in their last season, they have, like, this really great rapport back and forth.
It's so fun. All right, we should probably start wrapping this up, but what else do you want to say about Ghost Light before we call time on this one?
There's a couple of things, I guess, like, because I want to touch on the bigger sort of, like, themes and stuff that it deals with, because to me, like, that is actually, like, the true star of Ghost Light, even though it's, like, the thing that on multiple viewings it becomes richer and richer, because there's all these interesting ideas they have about evolution and, like, how that comes into conflict with the Victorian way of being that is set up with, they have that reverend character that visits the Gabriel Chase Manor at the beginning, that eventually, that his whole role there is, he's like, Josiah Smith has published some sort of work on, like elaborating on Darwin's Origin of Species, and so he's sort of pops up in part one and part two, kind of being like, this is all bullshit. Like, God, like made man. Like, there's no way that, like, my ancestors are some sort of primordial microbe, I think is a line he has. And then eventually, he has that great scene where Josiah is starting to decay, and he's sitting down with that reverend, and the reverend's, like, going off again on another speech, and then Josiah, like, I think hands him a banana, and he starts eating the banana while he's talking, and then eventually, like, his hands go down out of the frame, and they come back up, and they're monkey hands.
That's, because you know where they're going with it before he even becomes a monkey.
Yeah.
Because he's saying, like, it's that thing you hear, I mean, God, you hear that today from some, like, American conservatives of, like, no, there's no way I descended from a monkey, but they have him doing it while peeling and eating a banana. Like, the framing of that is so great, and watching Josiah, like, cackling.
Yeah, he just starts laughing, and then later you see, like, they pull up one of those curtains, and it's that reverend as, like, fully transformed into, like, a Planet of the Apes dude in that cage. And it has some, like Latin, like humanist Victorianus or something like that, as, like, he's a new part of the catalog. And so that whole, like, the clashing of those Victorian values with this sort of, like, with the revolutionary scientific ideas at the time. Also with, like, there's interesting stuff they do with gender, with having, like, Ace and what's her name? The other, the main
Gwendolyn?
Woman, Gwendolyn, yeah. They cross-dress in the first episode. Like,
oh, I love all that.
Encourages
her
to, like, dress up in one of the butler outfits. And, like, because there's also all this good stuff where, you know, the Victorian gentlemen are looking at Ace as, like, oh, shit. This is, like, it's a woman that's wearing, like, totally normal clothes before the Victorian standards. Like, she might as well, like, it's like a fucking, like, nude woman just walked into the room, basically.
It actually reminds me a lot of stuff, like, in the most recent Doctor Who season with,
yeah.
when you would have Bill in the past.
And yes, you'd get, like, Thin Ice.
Yeah, in Thin Ice or something, and you'd get kind of the racial attitudes. Here you get the sexist attitudes. And then, of course, because Ace don't put up with any of this bullshit, she goes and cross-dresses as, like, a butler outfit.
Yeah.
And looks and rocks it.
Yeah, she looks fucking awesome.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's great.
Like, all that stuff is great. And then I love the way that over the course of those three parts, the manor just descends into utter chaos as the, like, Victorian presumptions of civilization and culture start to decay to their, like, roots. It's almost, it's very Heart of Darkness in some ways of, like, just nature and life starts to encroach on the, like literally physically into the manor.
I think there might be an even better cinematic parallel, which is the Jean Renoir film, The Rules of the Game, which is this, that's one of those movies that's always on, like, the sight and sound list, but it's from the early, it's from the 30s, I think, and it is this film about a group of people in a mansion having, like, a very nice, you know, posh party in France, and over the course of it, like, the movie is basically an allegory for the falling apart of European civilization leading to World War II, and it does that same kind of thing where it's that's different because there's no real supernatural element, but it is about this, like, falling apart of this, like, rich, posh, ordered society over time. That's one of those, like, I definitely got that. That's a whole strand of, like, European film from that era. But, like, Heart of Darkness is good, too. I just thought, like, you know, this doesn't necessarily have the same precise, like, violent colonial stuff in it. Although that's hints of that.
Yeah.
But I was definitely, this was a connection I was making while watching
it. Because it's something that happens where you have all the, because the manor is just filled with all these stuffed animals, or you assume they're stuffed animals, but I think they're just, like, time-frozen animals. Obviously, they didn't have the budget to, like, actually have a bear there or something. But they do have that great bit, I think it's in part three, where the doctor opens up that drawer that, like, you saw had all these moths that you thought, like, oh, this is, like, you know, like, this catalog of all these different species of moths that they point out. And part one, and they're all alive in there, and, like, they start flying out, and it's just, like, filled with these bugs crawling around, and, like, the plants are very tropical. One of my favorite sequences in terms of, like, the direction is when Ace starts having that breakdown, when she's, like, you're starting to get a sense of, like, oh, what, like, happened here was she burned it down, and she starts breaking down in this hallway with all these stuffed animals, and the, like, animal sounds start getting louder and louder, and then she crumbles to the ground, and, like, police sirens and lights start flashing on her, and then Gwendolyn steps into the middle of the frame and the camera pans up to see her, and she's standing right in front of a peacock in the background, so that, like, the peacock feathers are around Gwendolyn as if, like, she's a peacock. And it's like that stuff of just the whole visually and like sonically and everything about the mansion just decays into utter, like, chaos and nature as the presumptions, as, like, I read it, the presumptions of Victorian culture start to completely decay and fall apart because they can't hold up to this realization of that there is nothing that separates humanity from animals, that we are animals. Also, like, on that token, I love, like, Light's role, like, both, like, sort of, like, straight in the story, but also subtextually, he has this very godlike presence of that, like, God cannot, like, our, like, traditional understanding of what God is, the, like, Judeo-Christian God, is not compatible with evolution, because with God, those things are stagnant, right? Like, with God, Adam and Eve are just created from nothing, and we are Adam and Eve, and we are made in God's image, and we never change, and we are always what we are, and that's the way that Light, who is a God-like entity, wants things to be, but he can't keep up with any of it, because everything is changing constantly, whether it is literally, like, the genetics of life, or if it's the culture, and the language, and the ideas, and the philosophies of life, and like human life are constantly changing, and God can't keep up with that because it doesn't make sense in this absolutist world that he lives in. Like, all of those ideas, I think, are baked deep into this script and in the visuals and in the performances. And it's one of those things of, like, you're saying that it feels like every person involved, like, understands about 70% of the plot. But what's magical is that everybody understands a different 70%. So you are getting this really rich cocktail of different ideas being expressed by the different people involved that I think are all culminating in, like, this really interesting like, even if it's not necessarily, I think, like, you know, it's not totally smooth or perfectly communicated, it's very richly communicated because it's so textured by all these different perspectives about colonialism and gender and evolution and religion and these ideas that are all kind of like bubbling up throughout the whole story until they just explode in part three into utter chaos.
It really is. Like, I love this episode while watching it. Talking about it with you over like the last hour and a half we've been recording this,
yeah,
I love it so much more because it is such a rich story, and it has to be discussed. I don't think this is an episode of Doctor Who you can like watch casually, go do something else, and not think about it. Like, it has to be digested, and I'm both. It makes sense, but I'm also surprised that I hadn't really heard of this episode before you picked it for this episode.
Yeah.
It's not one of those ones that like commonly comes up and people say, list off the best Doctor Who classic stories.
Right, yeah. Like, it's not in like the classic top 10 lists that would have like a Spearhead from Space and those kinds of stories. Yeah.
Right. But it should be. Like, it is.
I agree, yeah.
Amazing, and I mean, I not like it has to be in like your personal top 10. I just mean like it should be in the conversation more because this is one of the best ones we've watched, or at least it's on par with the best of the ones we've watched because we've watched lots of really good ones, obviously, because we're cherry picking. But like, I mean, even if you weren't, there's plenty of good Doctor Who.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is really a special Doctor Who episode, and even if it has elements that really do feel like other Doctor Who stories, like, again, you can't deny it has a vibe of, like, Robert Holmes, Philip Henchcliffe to it.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
It is so unique, though. It is not at all reducible to that. And it really is a unique Doctor Who experience, unique television experience, and just, it deserves to be seen. It really does.
Yes. Yeah. I think we've been going for a long time, so we should probably wrap it up. But I do want to, like, just so that, like, I have my bona fides, it's like, I have my degree, so I feel like I just have this, it's like, I see you... The fucking Mark Platt with the control character in Pygmalion and Eliza Doolittle is like all those references are there, and you can look that up if you want if you don't know what those stories are. But the whole like arc of the control character is also like mirrors this sort of like classic Victorian, like there are a bunch of stories that do this of trying to take like or like a Tarzan kind of thing of like taking someone who's like a jungle person or like somebody who's uncivilized and trying to bring them up and like make them into a proper like Victorian woman,
this
proper
episode,
ladylike.
This episode even references it with the Doctor and Ace,
yes,
where one of the people in the mansion assumes that's what he's doing, and Doctor Who itself has done it before with Leela. So like,
exactly, yeah.
Yeah, it's Pygmalion, My Fair Lady is the one people know today because it's the musical adaptation, but yes.
Yeah, but yeah, it's there's like, we could go on for like another hour picking shit apart from this episode, but
it's so good.
It's a special one. It is one of those Doctor Who's that like you like demands rewatching for sure. And it's like, this is probably my third time watching it, and now I'm like excited a year from now to watch it again because it's like, it's just so richly textured.
I just want to go watch more Sylvester McCoy.
Yes, because this is the first of a trilogy. So if you want to watch Curse of Fenric and Survival, I would recommend doing so because they're really fucking good.
Awesome. All right. Well, Sean, that's it. I mean, we've talked about something from all of classic Doctor Who, every Doctor. We are in the last season. We just talked about the anti-penultimate Doctor Who story, the last one ever shot for the original run.
Yeah.
So are we done? Is this it for our classic Doctor Who miniseries we're doing?
No, Jonathan. We are never done because there's one more person that stepped into those shoes before the show came back in 2005.
Oh, right.
There's one more person that we have to talk about. There is an eighth Doctor who had a TV movie that was okay?
Not good.
Not good. It drops some heavy Frankenstein references, so I like it for that because Frankenstein's one of my favorite movies in my favorite book, or one of my favorite books.
Has a terrible Eric Roberts performance. It's got back into good.
Like, yeah, the Eric Roberts as the Master is legendary for a lot of reasons and also should be forgotten. But it has a killer fucking theme song.
That's true.
Killer fucking theme song. Great performance by my boy, Sylvester McCoy. Other than for the current, now leaving 12th Doctor TARDIS set, it's got like my favorite, like I guess my second favorite TARDIS set. It's got an awesome TARDIS set. It has a lot of interesting things about it. The most interesting thing about it is that it has a fair-haired young British lad in the guise of Paul McGann playing the role of the 8th Doctor. But we have recorded a podcast a long fucking time ago. I think that was... like right when season 6 was starting, we did the Eighth Doctor movie, right? Because I remember
we did the Eighth Doctor movie with our original run. Right. When we did the first 7.
But I think that was like right at the end of that, because I remember being at your house and watching the season 6 premiere like around that time, because we watched the Eighth Doctor movie together.
That's the year 2011, so yes, it was 7 years ago now.
It was a long fucking time, but you know, I have forced myself not to pick any stories that we have already recorded, whether it is on this podcast or like 2 or 3 iterations of podcast ago.
Also, that's like one of the worst Eighth Doctor stories, so why would we pick it?
Yes, because while that is the, I guess, excluding Night of the Doctor, the like little 5-minute special they made for the 50th anniversary, that is the only like proper like televised version of the Eighth Doctor that is out there. But Paul McGann is a fantastic Doctor because they have a long, long, long line of audio dramas featuring him at Big Finish that go back all the way to the far, far-flung year of 2001 and 2002, which is... holy shit, that was a long time ago. But those are some of my favorite Doctor Who stories, like bar none, are from those old Big Finish audios. And so I think we would be doing an injustice to Doctor Who if we did not address the rich, rich world of Doctor Who audio dramas. And I'd be doing an injustice to myself and you and our listeners if we did not address that magnificent fucking wig that Paul McGann has on. So we are going to do a Eighth Doctor audio drama from 2002. What is my personal favorite Big Finish audio stories? Chimes of Midnight.
Yes.
And that will conclude our classic Doctor Who watch through / now listen through.
Well, I mean, we might keep going. We will conclude the first run of Eighth Doctors.
Of whatever this, like, this overview, the Doctor Who 101 that we have been doing. This will be
And I want to say, Chimes of Midnight is an older one. It's the 29th Big Finish story. I have it up right here. And so you can get it from bigfinish.com or whatever it is for pretty cheap usually.
For like $3, I think it is right now.
So, you know, some of the newer ones are more expensive. Like, I don't always feel like I have the money for their expensive box sets.
Yeah.
But this one, it's old enough. You can get it on the cheap. You should. It's cool. It's got Charlie Pollard, one of the best companions.
Oh, yes.
And I am excited because I have not gotten this far. I have listened to some Paul McGann audio dramas. I haven't heard this one.
Yeah. And if you enjoy creepy Victorian manners... like in Ghostlight, well, guess what? The Chimes of Midnight also has I think it's technically Edwardian, but is a very creepy old British manor, and it is a very unsettling story. You can also, for the cheap price of $125.77, buy the vinyl edition, the limited vinyl edition of The Chimes of Midnight, which they made because this story is so fucking good. They're like, dude, we gotta make a fucking vinyl version of Midnight.
How many vinyls is that for two? It's like a 2-hour long story.
I have no idea.
That's amazing. Anyway, we'll talk about that next month. Yes. Chimes of Midnight, Eighth Doctor. We'll be back in your ears next month with more classic-ish Doctor Who.
Yes, we are surpassing the wilderness years and going to the brilliant, brilliant Big Finish years.